Hi everyone, this is Chris Deasy, and it is so good this week to have Professor Bob Bowie as my nostalgia interview guest. Bob lives in West Kent. He works at Canterbury Christchurch University, where he is Professor of Worldviews Education. And we talk in the interview about how Bob started out studying classics and philosophy. He trained as an RE teacher, and he leads NYSA. And we discuss the question of what RE is. Indeed, we talk about whether people study religion because they are religious. That old chestnut. We talk about the census and growing up, in Bob's case, in Enfield in North London. And he remembers its Victorian parks. He was one of only three children in his class at school who had parents who were born in England. And he talks about why the city is a place to visit rather than to live. There are some things that Bob doesn't want to go back to, for example, the violence that was regular in his schooling. But he sees this in some ways as a gift because it gave him opportunities to discover forms of hospitality that he hadn't experienced before. And there's something about music that's interwoven in our neural structures. The cohort that you were with carries on in you. We learn why Bob used to reference Casablanca in his ethics classes. And we talk about what marks us generationally. And we learn why Saturdays were so important when growing up. Now, with nostalgia, what you took to be normal becomes kind of strange. We talk about purgatory as God whispering in your ear the story of your life, something that was relayed to him by Cardinal Basil Hume. We learn why Bob has respect equally for those who want to close the lid and those who want to open it. We talk about the problem with paradise being the unchanging nature of the blessed state. And we also talk about Bob's box of spaceships, and we learn why Japan was an extraordinary place to live. And at the end of the interview, we learn why Bob is more inclined to look forward than back. It was an immense privilege via Zoom for this latest nostalgia interview to catch up with Professor Bob Bowie. My name is Chris Deasy. Well, it is such a pleasure to have Professor Bob Bowie for my latest nostalgia interview. And it's great to catch up with you, Bob, even though we're in the same county. And indeed, under normal circumstances, we'd be working in the same city, probably only about a mile or less away from each other. But of course, due to lockdown, we might as well be on different sides of the planet. Where are you based, Bob?
Yeah, well, I mean, so I suppose, yeah, where am I based at the moment is in my study in my house, which is over in West Kent. So, and periodically in the garden, depending on the Wi-Fi on that particular time. And then in previous times, it was at Canterbury Christchurch University, and where we have a sort of an office on one corner on what was what we call the old Sessions House, which is actually was the old Sessions House years ago for Canterbury. So some connection with my interest areas anyway, and the building that I'm in, and that's where I'm based.
And that's brilliant because you're obviously a professor of education, and we have lots of contacts. Your name always comes up, and of course we had a conversation, I think it was about a year ago. And do you want to just say a little bit about what it is that you do? Because I think you've had some amazing travels, as I recall, and you're in perhaps a different place now to where you might have imagined you'd be a couple of decades ago.
Yes, I mean, I suppose a very brief resume is I started out, I mean, actually my first subject area was classics, classical civilization and philosophy. And then there wasn't a great deal of opportunity for jobs in that. So I traveled with my wife, and we went to Turkey and spent a year there teaching English in Istanbul. And then we went to Japan, and then came back to the UK and trained to be an RE teacher. And I did that for a few years. And then I went an opportunity came up at Canterbury Christchurch to be in teacher education. I did that for a few years. For 10 years, and then really moved more into research. And now I lead NYSA, which is a Christian Education Research Centre. So it's a research centre in the university that's about education, really. And that's what I do now. I'm still quite connected with the RE world, though. So that's one of the worlds I'm connected to. But the other world is church school stuff and what Christian education might mean and a little bit of ethics and philosophy in there as well. I retain that civilizational breadth of interest that I suppose is what I had when I was at university.
Because I always find that there are so many different strands. I did A level. I went to a church school in South Wales way back in the 80s, and I did my A levels in the early 90s. And it's so funny going to university to do. I did theology, and I'd done a religious education A level. I think it was called religious education. It might have been religious studies. I can't remember all these years on, but it was biblical studies. And of course, at the time, I thought, oh, religious studies means studying the Bible, because that was our curriculum. And of course, at university, we then find that religious studies actually was even further removed. You know, if anything, theology was a more obvious sort of point of connection. And it's just interesting in the way that, and now with my work in religion and film, and I've carved out various interests in life after death, nostalgia, Christmas. And there's a point when you suddenly realize that you are framing the curriculum, and there's something very prescriptive. When you're at school, you listen to what your teachers say, and you write copious notes, and you imagine that, you know, whatever the teacher tells you is going to get you through if you're a conscientious enough student. But it's so fascinating to be on the other end of the spectrum, as it were, and to be the person who's writing exam questions and essay questions and teaching modules, and realizing that as you're going through it, you're doing something with your subject which is far removed, couldn't be further removed from what you thought it might have been all those decades earlier when you started out.
There's a sort of a thread there that I really strongly resonate with, that because the question of what the subject is about remains a prominent question. And a colleague of mine who works in history education, she's doing some research with us, and she's sort of learning about the RE world and the RS world a bit, and she's kind of astonished at the nature of fundamental questions left unanswered or disagreed over, or with different possible pathways to respond to, which seems to populate religious studies, religious education at school level, but also I think at university level. And the very fact of this, the nomenclature, you know, I'm strictly speaking, I'm a professor in religion and worldviews education. So you've got this sort of, you've got worldviews, you've got religious studies, you've got theology, you've got biblical studies. So you've got this sort of milieu of bubbling differences. And one of the projects I've done quite recently has been on something which we're calling sacred text education, which might look like biblical studies plus, you know, other sort of sacred texts too. But I'm sort of thinking really deeply about, you know, reconsidering that process that sort of you were expressing there, which is you did the Bible and you thought, oh, it's not really about the Bible, it's about all this other stuff. And now I'm beginning to wonder, well, maybe it is about the Bible, you know. I sort of not exactly that, but particularly because I sort of feel more unclear about what happens when we call something religion. You know, what the categorization kind of brings with it a baggage, and I think a lot about that, you know.
Yeah, because I find it so interesting that these days when we have recruitment events, many of our students, when I ask the question, I've asked the same question over the last 20 years, you know, have you done religious studies at A level? And many of them will say, oh, no, we don't. And then you say, what do you do? And they say, oh, we do philosophy and ethics. And I think, oh, how interesting. I say, what do you do in that? And then they start telling me about the different arguments for the existence of God. Yes. And I'm thinking, and I said, oh, so you have done quite a lot of, you know, similar stuff. And they said, oh, no, our teacher says that we don't do religion. It's all philosophy. Yes. And of course, it's back to what I said. I did a religious studies A-level, and it was all Genesis to, it was Judges to 2 Kings. And we did John's Gospel and 1 Corinthians. Yeah. And of course, I went to university and then, you know, discovered that actually what I'd done was closer to a divinity program than actually religious studies. So again, the perceptions, and of course, now we do a lot of stuff at Kent in secular studies and courses on atheism. Yeah. Which might have seemed a bit controversial 30 years ago, but now it just seems like, you know, join the club, it's so odd that sometimes there are often perceptions about why people study what they do. And it's the elephant in the room. The number of students I've taught in religious studies who will put up their hand in a seminar and preface their answer with, I'm not religious, but.
And
I know what they mean, but those 4 words, I'm not religious, but, is you know, you can get a whole module and you get a whole PhD out of that.
Well, for sure. And clearly there's still a sense of needing to say that, because an assumption is you're studying this because you're religious. And behind that, there's something about religious that has baggage. And and I think that that's a really, you know, you could definitely make a case that for many young people, they've left the R word behind, and many RE departments learnt they needed to understand that. So, I mean, I've met people who starting their training year for being a teacher. So they've done their 3 years of their degree and now they're doing a postgraduate, and they have never realized they did a religious studies A level, because the sort of rebranding was so successful. They never actually looked at the words on the very certificate that they have, even the people bringing the certificates along to the interview, you know, because they have to show that they've got their qualifications. They used to have to show that they had the qualifications in that way. It's got the word religious studies on, but they would never have even called it. It's almost like they've got some special glasses they wear, that their teachers gave them, which obliterate that out. That sounds like I'm sort of making some case to rehabilitate the R word. It'd be an interesting exercise, but I'm actually more interested in whether the rejection of the R word leaves us with its shadow, that we don't free ourselves from it, and that we still think something like Christianity is a religion, and something like Islam is also a religion, and something like it is also, and something goes on there that is maybe not recognized. And I worry about the kind of that sort of side of things, because I think that to make sense of what you've just described, which is there is this rich range of spaces that we can go into, whether it's kind of understanding unbelief, or you know, whether it's understanding that, you know, there are at least three different kinds of agnostics who really clearly don't fit in the same category. So the term agnostic is really problematic. You know, I've only recently come across possibilian, you know, which is a sort of a kind of optimistic agnostic who you think, oh, I'd quite like to go for a drink with you. That sounds like quite, you know, because they're sort of exploring, as opposed to there's nothing out there to find out. You know, it's a very different sort of agnostic, you know. I wonder whether we have left R behind, really, truly, and if we're still in its sort of ripples. I see that certainly in terms of curriculum and schooling, which there's a whole thing we could talk about there, but I don't know.
Yeah, because even the census is a good example, and many people, well, including me, who will sometimes look at the list of options and find that actually it's very hard to know what, you know. Sometimes you think, I want to tick two boxes, you know, and you're looking at it thinking, oh, Christian or non-religion. And a lot of people, I think, will say, oh, well, you know, if you're not a practicing Christian, do you tick non-religion? But no, non-religion, if you look, talk to Lois Lee, has very specific contours. So it's not quite the same thing. And you might be a residual Anglican, or you might be somebody who has a lapsed faith, but in some way you still socially identify yourself with a particular faith position. And the people who then, you know, create those questions on the census may not be looking at it in the same sort of almost like complicated way that, of course, if you've got a degree and a PhD in this sort of area, you know, there is nothing straightforward about ticking a box on a census. And I think that gets to the heart of the problem.
It is, because that census becomes a kind of frame for the discussion. I mean, one of the questions I constantly go back to, is it what you believe or is it what you practice, you know, and which question matters more? And there's a sort of latent, there's a very definite story there, which is, and you see this in the kind of documents that direct how exams for schools are built, which is kind of belief comes first, and then after that practice and attitudes follows on. But my background, my family are Catholic, and I was raised Catholic, educated, and kind of still describe myself as Catholic, right? So although you know, probably not necessarily in a straightforward way, because we all seem to be less straightforward than we once were, and I'm not sure that it started with belief as much as, and it's not that it's not that the belief thing doesn't matter. It's just that there's the separation of practice. There's something weird about the separation. And I've thought about this more in terms of some of the language that we use. Sometimes you use a word and it's propositionally used. It's a description or it's a statement. But other words are enactments. They're sort of more about our embodied thing. So the classic one is, you know, when you say I do in front of in front of someone and a witness, you know, and a registrar and whatever, maybe in front of an altar, but wherever it is, you know, you're not just describing something. There's an enactment. There is a ongoing thing that happens, and that's kind of language is different. So it can't simply be about a belief either, because it's an ongoing will. It's a will to emotion. And so I'm kind of quite interested in the tidy divisions that we have. And I wonder if one of the consequences, maybe a better education, is that when we're presented with those quite simple question structures, it just becomes a bit difficult because people think, well, hang on a minute, what do you really mean by that? And maybe the answerers have kind of want a more sophisticated option than they're given because of the desire to be able to categorize, which of course is so important for statistical analysis. You need to be able to group. Otherwise, you know, that's how you get meaning, isn't it? You're grouping things together, you know, and you go, ah, well, this is a trend or this is indicative of something. Or
But how did the journey start for you? I mean, in terms of where were you born? What sort of childhood memories do you have? Because I always find it interesting, that whole, you know, relationship, and I do it through alumni events, obviously, through this podcast, that sort of, how did I end up where I am now? But if you were to put the clock back, what are the things from growing up that particularly stand out for you, Bob?
North London, Enfield, and everything that that means in terms of surrounded by roads and streets we were probably in a more kind of affluent area, so semi-detached houses, but also rows of terraces too. Victorian parks, as the way you encounter nature, and gardens. Enfield is littered with them, as much London is, but Enfield, it was beautiful. So there was the escape into nature happened in those Victorian parks. And then a thick sense of church and Catholic life in that. So, and by that I mean, it was explicit. Religion was always talked about, and I've written sometimes about my relationship with my mother, and you know, the long conversations that we'd have at the end of a school day in the kitchen about, I mean, you know, I don't know, this might sound strange to people, yeah, about the nature of God or the nature of a Trinity, or, you know, and that might sound a bit weird, but it all seemed very sensible to me. So it's a sort of combination of those sorts of things. But through the school, it was also an encounter with loads of different people, because although, I mean, it's a Catholic school, but Catholic North London meant migrant diversity. You know, I think I was probably I was one of three kids in my class who had parents born in England. Everybody else, half of my friends spoke a different language at home. And so it was a real encounter with that sort of diversity. And amongst that, a lot of working class families, although probably I would say we were more middle class in background, if you can use those measures anymore as well. But I had that feeling too. Although it's funny that I think about that, because I kind of don't go back. So, I mean, I don't physically go back very much, and I escaped to the country. I used to dream when I read Tolkien, which I loved reading. Part of that was the journey out of Hobbiton through into the, and of course, what I didn't realize then was, you know, of course, Tolkien was, you know, enamored with English countryside, and so it was a very particular countryside story, and what, you know, living, and I kind of followed Bilbo and Frodo out the door into, well, okay, West Kent. It's not exactly it's not the wilds, but eventually into West Kent, and stayed there. So but I have fond memories of that time, but I also have a sense of the city is a place to visit, not to live.
Yeah, no, you're right, because that's an interesting juxtaposition sometimes, that when you're in London sometimes and there's a real buzz, you think, oh, you know, this is a wonderful place to be. But, you know, I spent more than a decade of my life in Lampeter in West Wales, which was the opposite. And it reminds me of a time I was in Hawaii once, when you'd think, oh, this is paradise. But people who live there don't necessarily see it as paradise, and they want to escape to New York City. They want to go somewhere where it's really built up, because they need that counterpoint. But actually, something you just said there about growing up in North London, somebody else I interviewed who's now a priest, he was a student of mine some years ago. He had a similar experience of being one of the only pupils in his primary school who was white. And I think he said that he knew more about Sikhism than he did Christianity. Then he went to university, learned about Christianity, thought he was an atheist. Well, he was an atheist, or at least an agnostic, and then had the calling, and then has been ordained to the priesthood. So his trajectory, and he's only, I think he may be 30 now, but he was certainly in his 20s when I interviewed him a couple of years ago, is one that he could never have foreseen. So in your case, it must be interesting to go back on those conversations with your mother, to think about the education that you had and look at where you are now on the, as it were, on the other side of the fence as an educator, and wonder whether, you know, it's, you'd want to go back and learn all those things all over again in the light of what you've learned.
There are some bits of that. There are some bits of that that I don't want to go back to. I'm a bit reluctant to. So I'm going to say something else in a minute about schooling. Yeah. But one of the things, and I've thought about this, but especially recently when there's been a lot of talk of violence and violence. I mean, actually, violence against women. Violence was part of North London life and part of North London being in a comprehensive school. Violence was regular. Violence was weekly, not occasional. Violence mainly. For me, I was a recipient, a receiver of violence, although probably it was also in our culture. And I survived by becoming a member of a rugby team in the school, or the rugby. That was survival, because that meant you had people at your back. So violence, I don't want to go back to that, because that's not meant to be a criticism against the school or against the teachers. Violence was simply there. And the business of carrying a key around with you in your hand as you're walking home late at night, that was going home. That was, and as a male, that's what I was doing. Encountered violence outside, you know, as in, you know, sort of not just on the playground, but sort of in the moments of transition. I don't need to go back to that. And that was tough. But it was also normative. So you didn't even recognize it or see it. You didn't even, you know, the tolerance of a normal experience of violence just as part of daily and certainly weekly life is a sort of under, for me, it's an under account. I certainly have thought more this year, more than anything else, about, I haven't really recognized that. But the flip side of that was the gift that I think I was given, partly by my mother, but also by the Jesuits. So it was a Jesuit Catholic school, which for those who are sort of outside the sort of, you know, Catholic education world, yeah, there is something Jesuitical about Jesuit Catholic education. It has its own identity, and you know, we use language about like the charism of different orders, but there is something very distinctive about that. I'm sure lots of people have got lots of thoughts about that, but the thing that gave to me was a spiritual encounter, because there were opportunities, extracurricular opportunities, to explore silence and space and also forms of hospitality that I hadn't encountered before. Developed both an appetite and a capacity, I think, for encountering the sacred in all things, which is of course a common strand for what sort of Ignatian spirituality is all about. And I maintain links with all my Jesuit teachers, actually. And I write, you know, I'm still in touch. I work with some of them in education. And so there, I have a very strong sense of being given a gift there, which has seen me through all sorts of storms. And I would want that there was more space given to the kind of learning and encounter and experience that offered than some of the other things that maybe have take up the space in a school curriculum or in our idea of education. What I'm talking about here is, you know, experimental spiritual exercises, using silence and stillness, and then going into guided meditations, spending time with candles in fields. I mean, you know, kind of all sorts of things about which now we would see, probably we would use language of well-being about. But that for me is something which I know will be there till the end. Whatever other category box I might tick, there's no escaping that. Yeah.
Because I find as well that, you know, I often reflect, having children of my own who are perhaps the sort of age that I had some similar experiences to you, and I wonder what, and of course with through things like Facebook, you can sometimes find out a little bit about some of the people that you perhaps went to school with, and I often think, what's happened to those people, the people who do the bullying? Do they perhaps ever look back and think, think, ooh, maybe I wasn't a very nice person. Maybe they have no reflection. Maybe they don't think they did anything wrong. It was just the way that people did things in those days. That was just part of the culture. And they were one of many people who sort of were part of that kind of culture and apparatus. But I often wonder if they got children of their own. Do they perhaps sometimes just reflect and think, you know, maybe they don't want their children to go through the same sort of school experience that they had. And I find that interesting because I speak often to people who've been on the receiving end of some not very nice experiences. But you know, I wouldn't even think about even approaching somebody. I'm not even in contact with them who was on the other side. But I think sometimes it's hard to let go of the past. And I think sometimes we, you know, in the context of nostalgia, it's very easy to be very wistful about the past sometimes. And we often try and think of all the amazing things that we were doing and we're not doing now, and we'd like to get it back. But there's also an awful lot mixed in and literally contemporaneous with that, literally the same week. You know, you have some wonderful school experiences, yes, or university experiences, but at the same time, you were unbelievably stressed. And it's not as though you could say that was a good year and that was a bad year. You might have a good 20 minutes and a bad 20 minutes. And often the two of them are literally juxtaposed.
Juxtaposition, contradictory, sort of, these are the words. And it's very difficult to split apart something and sort of, what people think of the past, I think, will depend upon whether, I think that's also an interior, that's a question about interior, an interior journey, an interior education. I mean, I benefited hugely in life from sort of spiritual guides, so people who I've specifically had time talk to, also talking counselors, speech counselors, who you know, and the kind of benefit of a kind of psychoanalytical process, and also being struck that you can go an awful long way in life before you realize the layers within you that are there. In other words, it's quite possible that I think, and maybe in some sense, we all were probably bullies of some sort. I mean, I don't want to sort of equalize things, right? You know, that would be because there are different acts, and there are acts that have lasting damage on people that you know, and yeah. But there is a sense in which at some point there is a layer that maybe, you know, if you don't do the work of going into those layers, you can probably get on and leave it all in a box, and maybe that's okay, but maybe sometimes that will explode, and I think there's that's something about the value of the interpersonal sort of journey and the value of facilitators of that journey, which sometimes were teachers. I mean, I think of great humanitarians, my classics teacher, in fact, there was a whole team of them who, honestly, I think back and we kind of loved them. You know, they were amazing and they're brilliant human beings, as well as formal kind of different sorts of counselors who have sort of helped to unlock, whether that's in a spiritual practice space or in another space. And maybe we're now learning about the value of that side of human flourishing more when we talk about the well-being stuff. But
absolutely, because I'm thinking as well other sort of influences, because, you know, talking about the playground, I mean, for me it was always music, it was the charts. There was this sense of how we and often it was, of course, how we identified ourselves vis-a-vis our peers about the particular sort of musical tastes, and how often whether we would follow the crowd. I always sort of stuck to my guns on these things sometimes, and you know, my interests are the same. You know, I listen to the same sort of early 80s chart stuff now as I did then, because it's so in, I don't know why, you know, maybe other people are the same, but it's sort of integral to a particular period of your life, and in a way it's sort of part of your DNA as you grow up and learn things about the world. This is the soundtrack to that experience. But is that something that resonates with you in the same kind of way?
Definitely, and probably increasingly so. And I think there is something about music that gets knitted in. I'm sure it gets knitted in. I'm sure the neuroscientists will say, yes, it gets knitted in. It's kind of interwoven into the neural structures. So you go, yeah, that's that. You've got it there. And, you know, that would be one way of thinking about why we would want to return to those, and why it would be so, you know, so sort of kind of attractive to return to those. And of course, we've got more tools to be able to return to those now than, you know, okay, perhaps when times gone by, you'd have to keep your records and keep your tapes. But now we have, you know, my brother was involved in the development that went behind the kind of, you know, when he worked for Absolute Radio, Absolute 80s, Absolute 90s, Absolute, you know, that kind of development of the use of clever software engineering to be able to create a whole strand of radio station that touched your nerve, that sort of managed to really kind of capture your generational soundtrack. I think that is the case. I mean, one of the things I'm not sure about is when I think I've discovered something new, have I actually just remembered something forgotten, you know? And, you know, one of the experiences I had of that is my son, who sings a lot and in choir, I mean, choral music, sacred music, and also plays in orchestras, you know, has kind of reintroduced me to the classical music that actually I had a strong appeal to in the 80s. You know, so and I might think, oh, I'm discovering this anew, but maybe I'm being reminded of it. And there's a bit of a thing there, isn't there?
Yeah. And you mentioned that you feel that connection even more so. I mean, is it the point that is it the same music that you're listening to, or is that sort of the music a sort of almost like an invitation to branch out? So it's sort of like that's the starting point. But, you know, are you listening to the same stuff, or is it the fact that you've got the same kind of interest, but as music develops, then there are sort of new opportunities? Because I find it very interesting in my case that I'm almost beholden to those same sort of paradigms, but I feel that I never run out of learning things really about that sort of period as I listen to people who are now listening through those sort of nostalgia radio programs, the sort of sounds of the 80s or whatever, and you discover new things about those tracks and those artists that you thought knew everything about because they're now perhaps in their 50s and 60s and 70s and they reflect on their own careers. And it just feels that this is something so powerful that if you were part of that demographic, you were part of that, you know, particular, whether at school or university or growing up, then there's something about that which you could never impart in the same way to your own children.
There's something about cohort, which is actually, it's a great word. So the cohort that you were with, the cohort carries on in you. And I think it kind of remains, though you might have left all of those people in that time. Nevertheless, the cohort is still there, and I mean, probably for me, that's also as strong with movies, with films, and with, you know, the kind of the resampling that then happens of those moments, even in new films, when they throw back and where you recognize motifs and features which are actually capturing things that have gone on in previous movies. So I have quite a vivid sense of when I encounter something that is new but is actually actually deliberately sampling something of my cohort. I think probably that's something about, you know, that layer that was interwoven in that earlier developmental phase, and we are kind of beholden to that. We, even if we want to reject aspects of it, we, even in the act of rejection, that means it's there. You know, it's kind of, we would, otherwise we wouldn't need to reject it. You know, you don't need to carry on rejecting something if it's not there. whereas I think, you know, I think probably it is sewn in.
But because there's something, isn't there? But also the media and the medium itself of listening, because now, of course, in an age of streaming and an age of downloads, it's so interesting that younger people who weren't around when vinyl was the thing in the 80s and so on are returning to that format, and so there's, and that almost validates, I think, vindicates even that sort of, you know, the pleasure of going to Woolworths, oh, those were the days, or HMV or wherever on a Saturday morning and buying those records, because having the physical version of something that you'd listen to on the radio felt far more special than just having it as you know, literally, you know, it was great to hear a song on the radio, but you needed to concretize that. And I don't think that we've ever entirely lost that. And that's why, of course, you know, you go to the cinema, and I've never been into those superhero Avengers type films, but you see people wearing all the t-shirts and all the accoutrements that go with it. It's almost as though that they're watching this thing, but they have to wear something. They have to embody it in some way.
It does become a kind of cultural participation, And then it and then it becomes a narrative. Actually, it becomes interwoven into a narrative, and then it allows you to speak with metaphors which are born of it. So it's kind of a layer of your language, because you can make those references and you can call on them to make explanations of things. And in that process, if I'm listening to you and I also read the metaphor and read the memory and have a common connection, then we're together. We're together on at that moment, at that point, which is sort of quite, I think it's quite affirming. But then you get the incredulity when you encounter people who haven't had that. I remember teaching. I used to reference Casablanca in one of my ethics classes that I would teach, because there's a very interesting thing that happens at the end of Casablanca, you know, which is what Humphrey Bogart says and whether it's true or not, and whether it's both true and untrue. You know, it's probably both true and untrue at the same time. And one of these great this is one of the reasons why we really need to get away from suggesting that it's a binary argument, because you know, when he ushers her away, there's a truth and there's an untruth in what he says, I think. But you know, discovering a generation, the shock of discovering a generation of no idea what Casablanca is, the outrage, and then you start to feel like some sort of grumpy old person who is like saying, you really need to know what Casablanca is, and then, well, maybe they don't. I don't know. Maybe they don't. But you have to find some. Well, what's interesting sometimes is the next generation will find the new equivalent metaphor. So they will say, oh, it's a bit like in you know, Friends or The Big Bang Theory, or you know, the one where, and I would think, I've not seen any episode of any of those programs, and that generationally marks me, by the way, you know, so sort of you know, that's a good two decades at least. So you can still make those connections, but for some reason the fact that it was Casablanca and it was filmed in 2 weeks and it's black and white and it's kind of, you know, that's definitely a fondness of nostalgia. I mean, actually, just an aside, Saturdays were so important. And I had this, and my Saturday was rugby in the morning, which was brutal. Although, you know, forever I have been getting up early. I never, you know, because Saturday morning was always rugby and Sunday was always was serving at church, you know, so there was never a lie-in. Lie-ins didn't happen except in those rare moments of, you know, vacation time. And that's hardwired in now. A lie-in is hard work for me. But Saturday afternoon, in that slightly snoozy post-rugby state and sore post-rugby state, black and white films that used to be on in the afternoon. This marks me out because I was not watching Grandstand. I was watching the black and white movies, which were actually the movies of my father's generation, really. So it wasn't of the 80s. It was, you know, Fred Astaire and Laurel and Hardy and kind of this other sort of chunk of stuff. And so Saturdays were incredibly important in that sense. Yeah, I've been working quite hard to reclaim Saturdays.
Yeah, no, I had a similar experience. You've just taken me back. I think it was in 1995, and it was actually on a Saturday afternoon. And I think I'd been like invigilating an exam or something in the morning, so it probably was about sort of June time. And I remember I had to phone one of the utility companies because I was living in a shared household, and I think effectively it fell to me to sort some problem with the bill out. So I rang them, and the woman was like, oh, don't stress, she said. And then she started telling me this story about how normally on a Saturday afternoon she'd be watching an old like Sean Connery movie on the TV, or that was her joy. And I had this, and I thought, this complete stranger, so there's me phoning this utility company, and you know, and she was sort of telling me about her own sort of life story, and that always stuck with me, that there was this thing that growing up, when we only had a few channels, so you know, Grandstand, as you say, with Frank Boff, and you know, it was on BBC One. And then on BBC Two, there were all those treats, and often very sort of children-friendly as well.
I mean, my goodness, you know, the Carry On generation, some of that stuff and other stuff, which I think now they would be really cautious about when they released.
Yeah, no, and indeed, my old diaries are full of all these, you know, Saturday nights were always different Carry On films, like Carry On Girls, and you're thinking, how could you, you know, there's no way they could show that now, and they shouldn't show it now. In fact, I'm not sure they should have showed it then. But and yet they were often sort of watched by people like me in school who almost just didn't really realise.
That's another thing about the weirdness of nostalgia, though, isn't it? In that you realise what you took to be normal becomes strange. Yeah. And you look back and there were some of those shows from the 80s, which I mean, even if you exclude the ones that have profoundly disturbed people who we you know, we now know are profoundly disturbed, the sort of the Jimmy Savills and yeah. all of that sort of stuff. Even if you kind of put those to one side, there are these other categories which are still just like they are profoundly strange when you encounter them again now. And it looks weird. Why on earth? How could we have thought that was normal? And that is a challenge to, in a sense, a warning about how we judge the past, because you know it is a strange and undiscovered country too, and we must be, you know, careful about taking a flippant approach to sort of, you know, a kind of a generalized label, because yeah. you know. Where will we be in 20 years' time looking at this week? You know, don't yeah. kid yourself, you know.
And actually, I think the problem is if like me, you've got records, like literally recordings of like radio stuff from those days. And I often listen to all of those old recordings, you know, when I digitized them some years ago, listen to them when I'm in the car. And I find it really difficult because suddenly, you know, there might be a reference to Rolf Harris or they might yeah. play a Rolf Harris song, which at the time was like those silly covers he did of Bohemian.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it was funny at the time, a bit odd. It was a bit sort of off board, but we thought, oh, that's just a quirky character. But the trouble is, you know, what do you do with all of that? Because it's easy to say, oh, just, you know, wipe it clear, like they did with all those old Top of the Pops episodes, you know. And of course, I feel sorry for the artists.
Re-edited as if it never happened.
Yeah, and actually, they don't show them at all. And I feel sorry for those artists who happened to be on in the week when Jimmy Savile was presenting Top of the Pops, and they don't show any of it. It's like, well, it's not their fault, you know. So we don't get to hear their wonderful music because the person presenting it was obviously, you know, obviously now, you know, persona non grata. But what I find interesting is that in those days there were these very eccentric people. Who and we used to watch them on TV and we just took it for granted that they were there because they were there and because there was no alternative. Looking back now, I mean, my children don't watch live TV. They're always watching YouTube. I mean, they, you know, even my twins who are 6 years of age, they know exactly how to go onto YouTube and they choose their own programs. But in those days, we would watch live TV only. And I don't know what to do all these decades later when they come up on my old recordings, which were, you know, do I sort of, you know, press the delete button, or do I, you know, jump forward 10 minutes so I don't listen to this, or do I in some way just have to accept that was what happened then? And I think it would be worse in some ways if you try and pretend something didn't happen, because that means all the other associations and those conversations somehow just what we need to be ashamed of them in some way.
And I think I don't know if I've got an answer to the question of what to do with it. I think it's hard to what to do with it, because do you honor or dishonor the memory or honor or dishonor the suffering by eliminating? Of course, you mustn't uphold that would be terrible. And also, I don't mind the fact that in a broadcast medium, you have a responsibility to the unintended consequences of what might be there for people who have lived a life of trauma as a result of either the direct contact with these characters or an associated contact which they connect to those individuals because they experienced a similar kind of harm from someone else. And so there's a sense in which I, you know, the fact that it is broadcast means there is a risk, and there is a risk and the damage and the, you know, there is a kind of damage that not all will feel and that people are vulnerable to in particular. And therefore so I'm sort of, I don't know quite what my attitude then is to the issue of re-editing, but removing it is deadly, I think, because if we remove it and imagine it wasn't there, well, that's the danger. You then think it wasn't there because you've successfully rewritten the past. Well, are you sure it's not there now? And therefore are you sure that's not just a journey to say it never was? Now that's not the intention of removing it, but it could become the consequence of removing it. And so I'm cautious about that. I mean, you know, sort of, I said I was a classicist, and, you know, there are, you know, sort of, and I recently, I think it was Mary Beard was talking about, you know, sort of, do we need to be a bit careful about Nero and how we treat Nero, and, you know, kind of maybe the history of Nero is a little bit more embellished by the people who hated him afterwards. And maybe we need to sort of, you know, be careful. but then there was a they would, you know, then there's this thing of, but don't worry, your hatred of Nero then kind of becomes a cultural thing in and of itself. You just need to understand that that's not necessarily the same thing as a historically accurate account. It's something else. I do think there is a problem with people who live on with the suffering caused by those individuals, because I know that that can last. I mean, I know that sort of indirectly that can last for very, very long periods of time and are constant difficult things for people to manage in their lives today. And so there's a sort of a different kind of responsibility with the broadcast medium, I think.
Yeah, I think you're right. And also there's almost this, you know, perception looking back that everything was monolithic. That if we enjoyed watching silly things on the TV, we all thought it was silly and we all laughed in the same way. Looking back, the victims, the people who were, you know, whose voices only came out maybe in more recent years, what were they going through? What are they still going through? But what I do think is that there has to be some sort of critical engagement with it rather than an attempt to remove it altogether, because what you end up with is something akin to something like false memory syndrome, where you've wiped something clear, but of course you don't just take in taking out one memory of perhaps something you watched or something that you know, there may be conversations in the playground that led to other conversations, or maybe even, I mean, it's awful to say it, but like, you know, I wrote to Jim Will Fix and I was never on it or never was read out. But that was always like the thing when you're like 7 years old, you know, having that Jim Will Fix It badge was one of the things that you would, you know, look forward to doing. It was great to be on TV in prime time and to be, you know, have your dreams come true. Looking back, this all feels really sinister and really awkward, yeah. But if you pretend it didn't happen, then those things you hoped for, those letters that you wrote to the program wanting to be on, you know, in some way, what do you do with all of those? And I don't think anybody knows the answer. But my sense is that with nostalgia, and that's something that I think it's worth coming onto in just a second as well, is what do you do not just with those really great memories, those positive memories, but those negative ones as well? How do you process those? Can you learn from them? Can you indeed be nostalgic about negative experiences?
That's something that I really have lots and lots of questions about, because I think that there is a someone put it to me that, you know, opening the box and going back in and digging up can be something that's very important to do, particularly if the box is bursting open. But there's another side, which is if you go into those spaces and then you bring things out, then you have them out. And so you've got to then make sure you've got the capacity to handle them being out, to then decide whether you're putting them back in a box or whether you're living with them out. And you might not know that at the start. So when you open the box up, it's hard to know, okay, so what's going, you know, so once I've peeled that open and I've sort of kind of, there could well be an argument that it's better back in the box. If it's not bursting out, you know, and what you don't want to do is simply reignite the experience, repeat the experience and recreate the experience. There's a tension, isn't there, between adding to the suffering by revisiting the suffering. And yet there can be a danger in not recognizing the suffering too. And I suppose I was kind of, that's the thing about violence, which I've just thought of very recently. I mean, you know, really, because sort of men and violence is a really strange topic. I've just thought a lot about that, you know. There's a whole thing there. I mean, and you know, whether you call it sort of male on male violence or whatever, but you know, kind of sort of there's a mysteriousness there. And you know, having my father reminded me of a memory I had forgotten, which was when I was brought home by a good friend from school, who's one of the few I'm able to stay in touch with. I had lots of friends at school, but you know, many of them we've drifted away. Who brought me home after I'd really been beaten up out on the way home by some kids who just didn't like the look of me. And he brought me home, which was a big deal because he lived in a different part of North London. So he sort of redirected. I completely, and my father also reminded me of a retaliation that someone in the rugby team did on an opponent who gave me a really nasty tackle, rugby tackle. So, you know, which you can do if you want to, you can do a tackle that's borderline dangerous and nasty and probably would get censored, but with a purpose to say, you will now fear me for the rest of the game and you won't come anywhere near me. Right. And my father reminded me of the fact that my teammate kind of sort of retaliated and made sure that person knew that they had crossed a line. I mean, or you could say there was a bit of reverse aggression. Mm-hmm. To try and sort of in defense of what had happened. And I had both at one point, I had no memory of these, and then it all came back. And that's left me thinking about violence. And I don't know now, you know, I don't quite know now, you know, not, it's not that I have more fear. I don't have the fear of it that I had in London with the dark streets and the late nights and the waiting for a night bus for an hour or in an empty tube, you know, crossing town to get home. You know, I don't know. I don't have those sorts of times whether when back in those environments, it would return. But I do think it's better to be thinking about it and to be revisiting it in my context. That's, I don't know.
Yeah, no. Well, I'm somebody who's always kept a diary, and I find that actually, somebody was saying to me once that in the context of traumatic experiences, one way of ensuring that you don't get something like PTSD is in that sense having some mechanism for channeling it. I mean, some people need, and rightly so, and it must be respected that they don't want that lid to be lifted, and that's why also even when I do my podcast interview, I'm aware that for some people, some topics are perhaps not necessarily comfortable being addressed. However, on the other hand, there is an argument sometimes of just being able to say, what was that all about? And you know, I wake up sometimes in the night, or sometimes the last thing I think of before bed or the first thing in the morning is something which might seem in some ways random, but it's about something that I just can't make sense of, somebody's attitude, somebody's behavior, something that I've never been able to grasp. And when people say, oh, don't worry about it, it was years ago, don't dwell in the past, that's the worst thing you can say to somebody, because it's not the past, it's something that is eating you up now. And actually to find closure, you need to go forward with it and do something with that. And counseling might be one way of doing that, rather than putting a lid on it. So there's no one solution that works for everyone.
There's something in the Christian theological tradition about that, in the tradition that I suppose I'm most closely associated with, the Catholic tradition, which is purgatory. And purgatory is a really, I mean, you know, we could probably talk for a long time about purgatory. I'm not sure what it's got to do with nostalgia, except that I once read a note. I've got some of Basil Hume's writings, Cardinal Basil Hume, as was, you know, of Westminster. And he wrote very briefly, purgatory is God whispering in your ear the story of your life, and it's just interesting that the sense of needing to have an understanding of the story of your life, and the possibility that is an important process, that something about completion and something about, you know, the final summation of your life, the need for there to be a story, and that story, you know, I mean, obviously with the purgatory thing, you have all sorts of other connotations, but just the idea of that has lingered with me an awful lot in terms of, I think that in some way is capturing why it might be important to return from time to time, and why maybe sometimes we can never properly leave either. I'm never quite sure about that, whether we do genuinely leave, as I said to you before, whether we do genuinely leave the past behind, or whether we live on with it even if we are unaware of it. But I have a huge amount of respect for the say it's now time to close the lid, and I have a lot of respect for let's try and open that lid and do something helpful and meaningful, particularly if the lid is already opened up.
Yeah, and purgatory is actually a really good critical and reflective space, because I think we're all there. Because when I'm with my students, I run a course called Death and the Afterlife, and of course we talk about the binaries of heaven and hell. But you're right, because you know that there, you know, not all punishments should be, or not all crimes should be punished equally. And I think purgatorio, thinking of Dante, it's an interesting place and space, because that's where you have the chance for reflection. When you have reflection, then there's a chance to change, and there's growth, and there's transformation. And I don't think that happens. If you're in a blessed paradisical state, or also in you know, a state of you know, horribleness and evil, then in that sense, you may not have the same opportunity.
Is it better to stay in purgatory then, Chris? Is that the...
I wonder. Well,
it's actually your therapy class.
I wonder. I sometimes find that, because sometimes you can stay in the same place and feel that you have autonomy and some sort of control in that. And you have a chance to do something about something.
There's change. I mean, that's one of the, and I wonder if one of the slight kind of paradoxes about the notion of paradise is the unchanging nature of you know, whatever, however we want to characterize it, the blessed state. Because our experience of life and our experience of satisfaction is often peaks and troughs. Or troughs and peaks. I mean, I'm running at the moment, and you know, in fact, there's a whole other conversation to go about running, but long, you know, running long distances, the sort of what can happen after that in terms of satisfaction can only happen with the run, you know, to reach that point of, I mean, probably there's lots of activities like this of extraordinary exhaustion and then elation, which can come, you know, there is a sort of, from great physical activity, great struggle. But there's another version, which is also you recognize the value of the good times when you come to them out of the bad times. But if you never had the bad times, would you see what the good times were? I mean, you know, so there's a kind of a paradox with the blessed state, which always troubled me as a younger kind of sort of, when I was in sort of earlier theological formation, I spent a lot more time.
And I agree. And in the same way, I don't think nostalgia is really about the past. It's about the present, and where there's this perception of something missing. And it's that lack of completion that propels us both backwards and forwards, a sense of going forward to reclaim something that we think has been lost in the past. So there's a sense of rebuilding something. And of course, that can be taken into all sorts of quite scary extents, as we've seen in America. But that sense of trying to recapture something that we perceive was once there, but is no longer here now.
Now, I know you can see me, and it looks like I'm a little bit distracted, but I'm just looking for something, and I can't show it to you. Yeah. I don't know where he is usually, because you said then nostalgia is not about the past, about the present. And I wanted to then pull out, and I don't know where he's gone, my R2-D2 from 1978 wind-up from America that my aunt brought over. She would always come and visit from America with extraordinarily... just amazing things. I've got a land speeder in this study in a box up there. I've got a number of spaceships, Chris, which I will never allow. If you say, what do you want to, if I was to be buried, what would you want? If my box of spaceships can go with me, you know, that would tell the archaeologists a lot about what they'd need to know. But I want them here now in this study, and I have them in, usually I have it in plain sight, but I think the cat may have got R2-D2. I'm really worried about, actually, because... Yeah.
The idea, I think we have a very, very clear sort of image in our mind as to that takes me back as well to sort of circa 1978. I mean, I've only got literally one or two more questions, but actually I did want to ask you about Japan, because I thought, I mentioned Counterpoint earlier. I just thought that sounded like it was an incredible experience.
Japan, I mean, Japan has stayed with me. Japan is just extraordinary. Japan is where I learned most about what it was to be English. I don't think I knew what being English was until I'd been to Japan and came back. It was the encounter of strangeness and then the encounter of the strangeness of you. I mean, it was a kind of, all of that paradox happened with Japan. And from time to time, I will watch long train journeys recorded from YouTube train journeys around bits of Japan that I remember and bits I never got to. We were in Toyama, which is a county in Honshu Island, or the opposite side of the mountains to Tokyo, senior high school English language teacher. It's like a town where nobody locked their doors, because there was a murder 20 years ago, but no one could really remember it. So you don't lock your door. Why do you lock your door? Who's going to come in? You know, sort of the degrees of strangeness and difference from my experience of North London. Definitely a lot of space. So much less fear of violence anyway, from North London.
And have you been back to Japan since?
No. I'm very conscious that we saw it at a moment in time. So we were in Japan in 95, 96. And so it was still Jobs for Life. So the which has changed. It's still a mixed nostalgic memory because treatment of women in Japanese life. There's a long conversation to have about that. And yet, I don't know. I mean, I think we would love to take our children to Japan. And I think for the two reasons. One, to just try and understand if you want to understand the richness of diversity that this planet offers, you know, then going to Japan is one way of getting some spectrum of that. And but also it will teach you about all of the things that you cannot see that have come from your cultural kind of infusion that otherwise you might never see. I think when we came back from Japan, I was probably nodding, bowing 200 times a day. Because you just bow all day in Japan. it's kind of the formality of greeting and exchange. And so not bowing and face masks, face masks, which is commonplace, right? I mean, you know, the idea that you would have a cold at work without a mask, my goodness, you know. I'd love to go back to Japan. I mean, it's a strange connection because I was when the Fukushima nuclear disaster happened, I went to the embassy to sign the book of condolences and show my respect to the flag. And actually, I've got the flag is a sort of emotive thing because it's the same flag. And I have relatives or distant relatives, relatives, deceased relatives who were prisoners of war under the Japanese. You know, the flag is a, you know, and yet you kind of. There's something extraordinary about that culture, and I feel like I'm not even saying anything about it to make sense of why. But the impact on it stays with us.
But it sounds as though you've gone back in your memories, your imagination. So in many ways, it sounds as though whether you go back geographically or not, actually, but perhaps it would even be counterproductive to do that because it's made this huge impression, and I think it's obviously going to carry with you. And has made such a big impression. And I found that with my place of my alma mater where I went to university. It took me about 16 years before I felt ready to go back, simply because I'd stored up so many memories, good and bad, that I needed to process them first before I felt ready to revisit that space. And it came eventually, but it came, on, if you like, on my terms.
Yeah. I think that's probably the answer to the kind of question we've been exploring, which is on your terms. Mm-hmm. On your terms both when you decide you're ready or on your terms when you see it's necessary, whichever one it is, you know, but to avoid the shock. And probably deep down, as much as when I talked about Enfield and you know, there may come a time where I must return to Enfield. I mean, it's not that I haven't been back ever, but I've rarely been back, and that's deliberate. And probably there's a lot more in that about, you know, it might take me a lot longer to be ready to sort of return properly to return to see it. And now I know I would, what I have done though, is of course I've gone on to Google Maps and I've done walks. I've walked my old walk to primary school, you know, which I could almost do entirely, which was just, that was really quite an emotional experience doing that. The turns in the road, the bits that are unchanged and the bits that are changed. So there are options you can do, which there are sort of gentle ways to sort of, you know, paddle in that experience if you don't, not sure you want to plunge in yet.
Yeah, no, I agree. And you can sort of, as you say, do it on your terms, and you can do it in a way that feels right rather than pressured or forced. But my very last question, Bob, are you a looking back or a looking forward kind of person?
I don't know how to answer that. I at this point, if my answer could cause a storm, if I was to ask that question to round the table and then, you know, and give my answer, I could quite expect there to be a storm of refusal trigger. I think that as much as I do look back, I think I look forward in the end. And I think that even in my nostalgia, there's something I want to be programmatic about the future. There was something I was privileged to talk to at our remembrance service a few years ago, our church a couple of years ago, to cover for someone. And I was trying to make sense of, you know, with this, we have a lot of young people, we have a brilliant local uniforms groups, all of the uniform groups, one of the largest in the area. It's fantastic. And my children have had all sorts of benefits from that and are still keen members and supporters. And I know many friends who have sort of dedicated volunteers to young people through that. And this is the one moment where there's 150, like the whole village, the village youth cohort gets together in a very special way. And I was trying to, you know, what is the sense of remembrance and the point about remembrance? There is a recognition in the past, but it's for the now and the future. In other words, don't kid yourself that it resides back there. It's happening now. You're building it now, and it looks forward. And I think that's where I am. So maybe I lean forward.
Bob, that is a very well processed and thought through answer. But Bob, it's been an absolute pleasure to catch up with you. Thank you for being my guest this week.
Thank you so much, Chris. No, I've really enjoyed it, really appreciate it. And it's been really interesting.